Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
What are the market prospects for the nation's pork producers?
There isn't a lot to say about pork right at this point.
By that now, USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Chekanowski says his team of analysts don't want to change the basics of their previous pork-related forecasts until after USDA releases its quarterly hogs and pigs inventory report. That comes on the 22nd. But checking on what they have been saying up to now, it looks like for 2024, pork production and hog prices both will be higher than this year.
Prices are expected to be up year over year for our 2023 prices. Forecast $58.70 per hundredweight. That's expected to increase to $60 per hundredweight in 2024.
This 2% higher price coming even with a projected 2% increase in pork output next year. Gary Crawford, Washington.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Earlier in the month, Republican members of the Senate Ag Committee called the disaster assistance program from USDA a disaster, talking about the 2022 ERP, the Emergency Relief Program. Now, some of the background, they say, is the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2023 included $3.7 billion in ag disaster relief to help farmers and ranchers financially recover from weather-related crop and revenue losses. And in a letter, Republican leaders of both the Senate and House Ag Appropriations Subcommittee said the intent of Congress was to mirror the funding and direction for ERP assistance in 2020 and 2021, and that the ERP payments were expected to be factored, given the budgetary constraints related to the funding appropriated for the Ag Disaster Aid and economic losses experienced by farmers and ranchers. But rather than equitably factoring all payments by the same pro rata amount, USDA, they say, instead chose a progressive payment factor approach, benefiting farmers with smaller losses at the expense of farmers devastated by natural disasters with more significant financial losses. The payments are then, again, prorated by 75%. How does it work? The initial payment amount for the ERP nearly identical to the previous methodology. However, new modifications to the program payment include 1, use of a progressive payment factor, and 2, the elimination of the farmer paid crop insurance premium reimbursement for certain producers. The progressive payment factor, they say, acts as a de facto payment limitation despite the clear direction from Congress on payment limits, and it reduces the ERP initial payment progressively as economic losses increase. So, here's an example. A farmer with an economic loss of $2,000 would be eligible for $1,500 in compensation, with the initial payment and $500 in a possible second tranche payment resulting in full compensation for a weather-related loss. Meanwhile, a farmer with $50,000 in losses would receive an ERP initial payment of $7,500, representing 15% of the economic loss, and if a second payment is made, would receive an additional $2,500. Importantly for farmers with large weather-related economic losses, they say, a large portion of their economic losses not covered by this version of ERP benefits sharply decline as economic losses mount to the extent that a farmer with $100,000 in losses is only guaranteed to receive an ERP payment of $11,250 or 11% of the total loss. Both members of the House and Senate Ag Committees and on both sides of the aisle are upset. They're not alone. Over 140 state and national farm organizations have written to USDA for clarification. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
How important is grain marketing for Illinois grain farms after harvest? I show post-harvest marketing is a big deal. In any given year, roughly 60% of production remains unsold at the end of the calendar year on December 31st.
Joe Jansen is a University of Illinois ag economist. He uses data on farm inventories and marketing activity to quantify the significance of post-harvest grain marketing. He finds that roughly 60% of Illinois corn and soybean production remains unsold at the end of the year, and it underscores the importance of careful post-harvest marketing strategies for farm profitability.
Harvest is essentially complete in the state of Illinois. Now farmers must face the post-harvest grain marketing choice to either sell promptly or store grain for sale later. This differs from pre-harvest marketing, where farmers make sales in expectation of a harvest whose quantity is unknown. After harvest, farmers have sized up their crop and have to decide how much of their uncommitted bushels to sell immediately or store for potentially higher prices later in the marketing year. My article on FarmDocDaily emphasizes the significance of the post-harvest grain marketing decision, especially for farms that have made minimal sales before harvest. In this new article, I quantify the post-harvest grain marketing challenge in aggregate for corn and soybeans in the state of Illinois. I consider three measures of grain available for sale as of December. Two are publicly available aggregate numbers from the National Agricultural Statistics Service, the farm marketing weights by month, and the on-farm grain inventories as of December 1st. I compare these to measured data on farm-level book inventories held on farm balance sheets from data from the Illinois Farm Business Farm Management Association. Farm marketing weights represent the proportion of the marketing year's crop that is marketed in a given month. For each of the months in the September through August period that is the corn and soybean marketing year, the marketing weight gives the proportion of grain marketed in that month. A look at average marketing weights for corn and soybeans over the past 5 years shows a significant share of the Illinois crop is marketed at or shortly after harvest. Marketing weights in October through January are much higher than other times of the year. There is a big spike in January as some of the crop is held so that sales can be realized and revenues deferred to a new tax period. While monthly marketings in the latter half of the year are smaller, in aggregate they add up so that the majority of the crop is marketed after December. This share to be marketed is slightly higher for corn than for soybeans. My findings indicate that on average, roughly 60% of production remains unsold at the end of December in Illinois. Farmers therefore bear significant price risk post-harvest, and managing this price risk is an important farm management challenge. In the article, I compare the farm marketing weights published by NAS to other measures of the crop to be marketed, such as on-farm grain in storage and book inventories. I do so for the period from 2003 to 2022 for both corn and soybeans in Illinois. I find two notable observations from these aggregate data. First, the proportion of the crop that's marketed post-harvest doesn't vary a lot across years. It doesn't appear that as a group, farmers change the pace of their marketing activity much in response to changing market conditions. Second, book inventories from farm financial records closely follow the movement in marketing weights. This suggests that FBFM data on book inventories are informative about the pace of farmer selling and the farmer's inclination to sell or store. The data I have underscore the importance of post-harvest grain marketing for farm profitability. The size of this problem suggests farm profitability depends on a careful evaluation of the costs and benefits of different post-harvest grain marketing strategies.
Again, Joe Jansen, agricultural economist with the University of Illinois. Find out more online, farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
International trade and our success in foreign markets is undoubtedly one of the greatest successes of the U.S. hog industry.
Howard A.V. Roth is a Wisconsin hog producer.
With roughly one quarter of American pork being sold abroad, it's safe to say that these export markets play a major role in impacting the size of our industry. A third of the average value of a hog can be directly tied to exports, and in 2020, we exported over $7.9 billion of pork and pork products to over 100 countries. The size of our industry has been growing. 60,000 hog farms currently support around 500,000 jobs up and down the supply chain including feed providers, farm operations, packers, retailers, financial service, port workers, and many others. Of these 500,000 U.S. jobs, over 100,000 of them are directly tied to pork exports. These jobs are widely diverse and high paying. Right now, wages across all sectors of the U.S. economy are rising rapidly to be competitive. However, that trend started even before COVID in our industry. In states like my own, or in the industry's largest state, Iowa, the average wage is over double the minimum wage and comes with highly competitive benefits to attract the main and maintain talent. In a state like mine, a wage just shy of $15 an hour is no significant sum. Wages and benefits are only part of the equation. Most farmers promote entirely from internal employees. As operations continue to grow with expanded export markets, hog operations value those who know the business and can train others. Consequently, hog farmers offer security and satisfaction in a career in agriculture. Since before the pandemic, and despite other risks such as animal disease or market volatility, our industry has served as a major employer in the rural America, growing rapidly and constantly hiring for well-paid work. While our industry has not been immune to issues that come from workforce shortages, we are glad to be able to count on the continued growth in our real employment, facilitated in part by international trade. Therefore, it is imperative that the administration focus on expanding markets for U.S. agriculture and pork around the world. The biggest export opportunity for our industry lies in Southeast Asia. Earlier this year, and after years of work, the Philippines government unilaterally lowered their tariffs on pork to combat food price inflation. Since then, U.S. pork exports have increased by over 150% in the first 7 months of the year. These markets across access victories are wonderful for the industry and U.S. workers. But we also should focus on comprehensive market access packages like those offered in trade agreements like the CPTPP, which our competitors are part of. We encourage the administration to enter into broader market access negotiations. We also want to thank the administration for the work and help that are did in the ports, and we're hoping that will help clear up some of our backlog port.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Tony, we're paying this year, we're projected to pay $1 trillion on the interest alone just to service the debt.
Representative Jody Arrington from the 19th District of Texas is chairman of the House Budget Committee.
We don't pay that much for all of national defense for the greatest country in the world. So we're in trouble, and we've got to intervene and change course, or we're going to have a debt crisis. It's going to undermine, by the way, and jeopardize farm bills and safety nets for seniors and the military. I mean, it will upend the republic. I mean, this a Greece-like debt crisis would be, I think, it's the worst-case scenario and the biggest threat to the future of our country. That's what I obsess about, quite frankly, every day as budget chairman. The debt commission is just a way to get some of the most thoughtful leaders from both chambers and from both sides of the aisle, because some of the biggest entitlement programs that are not paying for themselves, that are driving the debt, have to be addressed along with the solvency. I mean, Social Security beneficiaries will take a 20% cut if Republicans and Democrats don't come to an agreement on how to address the insolvency and address the sustainability and to make sure that this program's there for future seniors, not just the ones today. So I'm excited. Speaker Johnson's asked me to run point on it, and we've had great bipartisan hearings, and we've got good consensus, and hopefully we can get to a place where we can dial the politics down and get into the problem solving, and then we can have an up or down vote like a BRAC, you know, like the BRAC Commission. We can have an up or down vote, and we can actually do something good for the country, and we can put partisanship aside and really put our nation's fiscal health in better stead.
How can that be done, though, with so many wanting to focus on climate change? Representative David Schweikert from Arizona.
A couple years ago, I came across an article of some scientists that actually had been focusing on methane. Those of you who actually care about math, methane apparently has a substantially higher impact, according to formulas we're given, but a much shorter lifespan in the atmosphere. And the capture of methane was going to cost a fortune. Some of the early Biden administration rules of they wanted to cost for upstream and downstream of production of natural gas. And the scientists wrote this article saying, hey, did you know clay, when it's also adjusted, I believe it was with copper oxide. You get the joke here if anyone's actually has a scientific brain. Clay, kitty litter with copper oxide, it acts like a methane sponge. And it's incredibly inexpensive. I proposed it to some of my Democrat colleagues who claim to really, really, really care about climate change and methane and all those things. And they just looked at me like I was a heretic because I was giving them a solution that didn't require massive government subsidies. But now, here we are a little bit later, and the articles continue on, hey, the ability to do the capture and even the ability to use that methane capture in agriculture and the fact that there's actually even some new attempts to do it, and you don't have to bankrupt us. So is it enough to come and give speeches about how much you care about climate change and then not actually understand the science that makes it so you can do something without crushing people's livelihoods, without crushing your retirement and your next future generations in debt? Call my office. We have dozens of these articles we collect. We just subscribe to some really crazy blogs and scientific publications. But in this place, does anyone actually read the literature?
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
As we look at forage supply this year, I think in general we're probably in better shape than we were a year ago.
Dr. Mike Brook is Kansas State University dairy specialist looking at forage as we roll into the first of the year.
A year ago, we had major drought here in the western part of our state as well as the state south of us. So at this time last year, we were moving a lot of forage, particularly grass, hays, and straw, actually out of Kansas into the southwest part of the United States. Today, that's not the same. We don't have that strong demand that we had a year ago. However, our supply of things like prairie hay and grass hay tend to be a little bit limited here in Kansas. We do have some supply available. It's probably higher price than what you would like to pay, but it is available. So for our dairy herds, what do we need to be thinking about in terms of assuring that we have enough forage to make it through the winter and the spring? Well, first off, doing a good job on inventory and understanding exactly what you have on hand in terms of silages and dry forage is very, very important. Secondly, I think you're going to have to probably look at how you minimize the use of certain forages in feeding your dairy herd. So some of the things you're going to need to consider is how can we substitute in some crop residues, corn stalks, maybe milo stalks, maybe some sorghum silage or sorghum hay that we have harvested. How do we substitute that in for some of the grass hays that we typically use in our dairy diets? We may not want to totally replace them, but we may need to replace part of those forages so that we can have enough to stretch through the total feeding season. So you need to work very closely with your nutritionist, you know, and there are some nuances to doing some of this. For example, corn stalks can be an excellent partial forage replacement for things like dry cows. However, when you try to feed corn stalks to heifers, consumption is probably going to be a bit of a challenge. Maybe you can grind them fairly fine and get some consumption out of those types of forages with heifers. But again, it's probably going to be fairly limited to what we might be able to do with dry cows. As you look at your lactating cows, alfalfa hay continues to be available, maybe a bit pricey, but it is available. If you're trying to conserve on costs there, you might want to work with your nutritionist to look at how we might substitute in just a little bit of straw, maybe only a pound or 2 pounds of straw per animal per day to reduce the amount of alfalfa hay that we're actually using in the diet, keeping in mind that straw that we add to the diet is really just for roughage. It doesn't really add a lot nutritionally to the diet. So we're going to have to feed a little bit of extra protein, a little bit of extra energy to make up for the differences in protein and energy between straw and something like alfalfa hay. I would also encourage you, if you're short of forages, you really need to start identify where you are going to purchase those to make it through the feeding season. And I would suggest that you do that fairly soon. Waiting could result in a cost savings, but there's no guarantee of supply as we get later into the feeding season. So assuring that you have enough supply available for your herd, including replacements, is critically important as we move into the winter months.
Kansas State Dairy Specialist Mike Brook. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I am Manuel Almira Manny, the executive director of the Port of Palm Beach. For those of you who do not know where the port is located, we're about 75 miles north of Miami. My first job out of college, I was working at a steamship line called United States Lines. I was selling space on a shipping container ship. And that's all I've done in my whole life, is being involved in the shipping industry. You know, seaports are very similar to airports. They have the proper facility so that when a ship arrives, the tenants and shipping companies can conduct their business in the most efficient, profitable way. Port authorities do not own ships, and they cannot tell the vessel where to go. What can they carry? Market forces determine that. What ports can help is to facilitate trade, working with food exporters to get states and federal grants to build new cold storage warehouses, and working with importers to get winter melons imports stored in foreign trade zones with the accompanying tax deferment. In the United States, the top five U.S. agriculture exports are soybean, corn, tree nuts, pork, and beef products. You probably know the numbers. I'm not going to bore you with that because they're quite large and very significant. The U.S. seaport industry supports over 31 million American jobs. That includes mine. At the Port of Palm Beach, with only 165 acres of available acreage, made us a container port, one of the smallest container ports in the country. Yet, due to operational efficiencies, we are the 18th busiest container port in the United States. Among 15 billion in goods that are moved through the port each year, 2 billion worth of food goes to the islands in the Caribbean. Our port and the tenants are responsible for over 3,000 direct jobs and another 6,000 indirect jobs. Additionally, over 700,000 tons of raw sugar are shipped through the port into the northern states each year. Over 80% of container volume is exported here at the port, and most of the imports containers are empty. We are already doing our part to improve the balanced trade in the country. From our locations, ships can reach countries in the Caribbean basins in hours, not days. This is very convenient because most of the Caribbean islands today depend on Florida for their goods and food distribution. Let me tell you why. As the Caribbean island continues to grow, less and less land is available for farming. Hence, they need the supply from outside of their own countries. This is why our location is so convenient, because shipments of much-needed goods and supplies can reach the stores in less than a week. The demand for food supplies comes from two types of consumption: local consumption and passengers on board cruise ships that demand to eat exact food they consume at home. So in summary, all U.S. seaports can be the connection point for either bulk shipments of grain or food ships in containers of all sizes, dry or refrigerated food items. Ports are ready, willing and able to connect between the grower and the foreign distributor.
And this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
When it comes to the makeup of farms in the U.S., most, 97% specifically, are family farms. And most of those, 88%, are small-sized family farms. But what is the makeup of production by commodity for farms? USDA economic researcher Catherine Lacey says, based on the latest America's Farms and Ranches at a Glance report covering calendar year 2022,
large-scale family farms dominate the production of most commodities, including beef, hogs, cash grains and soybeans, cotton, dairy, and specialty crops. In the remaining two commodities, poultry and eggs, and hay, small family farms and mid-sized family farms dominate the production.
As for non-family farms, commodity production value ranges from 5% of all poultry and eggs produced in our nation last year to 19% of all specialty crops produced in 2022. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.